Welcome to the Stanford Psychology Podcast, where leading psychologists come to share their most recent work. I'm Angie, and for this week's episode, we have Dr. Judy Sphan, an assistant professor of psychology at the University of California, San Diego. Judy's research is at the intersection of computational neuroscience, cognitive science, and artificial intelligence. But in this episode, she is going to talk about blocks. Yes, you heard that right. She will be sharing with us her recent work on people playing with blocks. More specifically, we will talk about how the way people play with blocks can tell us about humans' core learning mechanisms. Without further ado, here's our conversation. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. And today we will be talking about a recent piece of yours on CogSci called Learning to Build Physical Structures Better Over Time. So how about we start with some introductions on this work? What was this study about?
So I feel compelled to introduce myself, even though you just said that I didn't need to, because that may provide some more context for the work.
That will work
too. So I promise we'll get there.
Okay.
So my name is Judy Sphan, and I'm an assistant professor of psychology at UC San Diego. And I'm fascinated by how people, humans, use various physical representations of thought to learn, communicate with one another, as well as imagine new things, create new things. And so basic idea that's really motivated a lot of my scientific work is that, you know, an account of how we use these technologies, these kind of cognitive technologies to organize our thinking. So, you know, our notepads, our whiteboard sketches, our maps, our blueprints, like our prototypes, you know, all of those are really essential for understanding what makes human cognition so special. Mm-hmm. And so with this study starts from, you know, thinking about the kind of usual approach in cognitive psychology, where, you know, we began with trying to make sense of like how we understand objects when we look at them from afar, you know, and how that experience is related to the way that we understand the world when we tinker with objects and we interact directly with them. And so like the standard mode, a kind of classic approach in psychology for studying how we perceive and understand how objects work is by showing people some objects in a lab, or more accurately, pictures of objects under controlled viewing conditions, and then seeing what they do. Either, you know, whether they can name what kind of object it is or describe its properties. But lots of objects aren't just static entities that we stare at. They're also, you know, we as a species are the tinker with objects, right? And it's that kind of tinkering behavior that's, I think, allowed us to realize that certain rocks could be used as axes, or that like trees could become logs that when assembled in a particular way could become our homes. And, you know, fast forward, and then we've really expanded the set of objects that we've, you know, tinkered into existence. You know, just think of the devices that we're using to record our voices and the incredibly powerful computers that we're using that are, you know, we can store in our pockets. Basically, the kind of kernel of the idea that led to this study is that half of our understanding of how the world works, you can think of as being this analysis step, breaking something really complex into simpler parts. Doing this with light using a prism is a really iconic, you know, to create a rainbow is a really iconic example of this analysis step. And this is the kind of move that we strongly associate with science. Mm-hmm. The other half is the synthesis step, right? So passing that rainbow through another prism to get a white beam of light again. This is the kind of step that we associate with engineering. But both directions are important and help constitute a complete picture of how the world works. And so the question that we were asking in the studies, you know, or like not just this one paper, but this, the kind of fundamental research question that inspired us to begin with this study is, you know, what are those foundational cognitive ingredients that you'd need to understand how people accomplish both of these feats of like both analysis and synthesis together. So this paper led by Will McCarthy, who's an amazing PhD student in the lab, as well as colleague David Kirsch, who's in the cognitive science department at UC San Diego. We designed a study in which there were a set of physical structures that could be built from virtual, in this case, virtual 2D blocks. Kind of, you know, imagine the kind of like wooden block set that you might have played with as a kid, but like a video game version of that. And what Will did was show these towers to lots of different people whose job was to recreate them from a set of blocks given to them. But it wasn't that straightforward because these towers could, in principle, be reconstructed in lots of different ways. And in fact, people did find different ways to reconstruct them. And also, the participants could only see the silhouette. So they had to figure out, given just the silhouette, how to decompose it or analyze the tower to break it into smaller pieces. And the way that the towers were designed, they could easily back themselves into a corner. So maybe if they placed a block that was too tall in one place, they would not be able to fill this other gap, or they might be forced to overflow or underfill here. And so that's how they were designed to be challenging, you know, to reason about. And so lots of people made errors the first time they, you know, attempted this task of analyzing the tower and reconstructing it from those components. But we weren't so cruel as to not give them another chance. So these participants also got to build the same tower again later. And that we found remarkably that people got better each time they attempted the tower. So, you know, even after one or a few attempts, people improved substantially. And the way in which they improved reflected convergence across different individuals who weren't able to communicate with one another in any way, converged on a smaller set of solutions to this task. There are still lots of different ways of carving up the tower, but we observe this convergence between people over time. And so
I guess I'm kind of wondering about, like, by solution, do you mean that the way that, like, the procedure, like which blocks go first and which block goes where?
Exactly. Exactly. So we measured performance in multiple ways. You can think of someone as being successful in reconstructing a particular tower if they can place blocks in a sequence that leads to a stable configuration. So there was simulated gravity. So the tower could fall over if it was not balanced. And if every bit of the silhouette was covered exactly with no overflow or underfill. There's another measure that we use that we report in the paper. We used a metric that is known as the F1 score that balances between coverage of the tower as well as not overflowing. And this is a way of, you know, measuring how well people could reconstruct the tower in a more graded, continuous way. So rather than it being all or none, perfect or not, people could, you know, do better or worse on each attempt. And so we used both measures to track performance.
And you were saying that across individuals, as they get better, they kind of converge on specific ways that they're constructing. So
yeah.
What are those solutions? Are those just like intrinsically better than others?
Yeah. It's a really great question. And it's one that we've been wrestling with since we first conducted the early versions of this study about a year ago. So if I may, there are these two questions that we've been wrestling with. So the first, the one that you raised, is really important, which is what explains how people can learn from just one or a handful of these experiences and arrive at this smaller set of solutions that is still varied, but like what characterizes those solutions? And the second question is, you know, what explains people's first attempts on this task and the kinds of biases that people bring to the tower building task to begin with. And like, why are some errors more common and some solutions more common, even on that very first attempt? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, to answer both of these questions, we've had to dig in a bit deeper. And the idea that we're currently pursuing to answer the first question that you raised is that perhaps people might initially parse the tower in some way at a glance, that their way of segmenting objects into their constituent parts may be shared to some extent, but there's still quite a lot of variability because these are kind of puzzles and they're kind of hard to parse. And there are multiple ways that you can break these towers into substructures. And the hypothesis, the working hypothesis that we're currently testing is that the experience having to actually synthesize a tower from scratch quickly teaches them whether that was a promising way to parse the tower visually or not. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of initial uncertainty about how to parse the tower. But then once they have some experience building it, there are these constraints that are made really obvious, including constraints from gravity or certain kinds of support relations being stable or not. And if they are backed up into a corner, for instance, they have to reconsider their strategy. And then once they hit upon, a way of decomposing the tower into a sequence of block placements that just work, they can stick with it. Mm-hmm. And so the kinds of solutions that people seem to converge on do appear to have, they must have this property of both being reasonable ways of breaking the tower down visually, but then also subject to these physical constraints, given that it's a tower made from these blocks subject to gravity. And just something to clarify is that even though there was this convergence between people, it didn't mean that different individuals were building towers in the same way, exactly the same way, block for block. So in fact, it was extremely rare. Basically, there were no two people who built the same tower in exactly the same way. But instead, what we mean by convergence is that there were smaller sequences of block placements that people discovered and converged on. So maybe a sequence of two or three or four block placements that were particularly useful. And that suggests that those subsequences might be really good candidates for those kinds of parts that people are, able to break this complex object into. And those might be really good candidates for both parsing the tower as a visual object, as well as when they're needing to, synthesize it from scratch. What are the, structural motifs that they can reliably recall and use in order to build this complex structure? The idea is that, these might be the kinds of chunks that people discover, and that there are some chunks that work really well, and that people in this task have to discover these chunks for themselves, and that these chunks might share some properties, including, they involve blocks that are nearby or involve some kind of arch within a tower. And like, once you can think about and represent that substructure as a unit, that unit becomes easier to recall and use again in the future, maybe even in like a new context.
I see. So I know we've been talking about this like building tower, but this experiment, which I think really cool, is that this is actually like a web-based games. So what participants were actually doing, if I'm understanding correctly, is basically just playing a game online and doing the mouse click and drag thing with like little blocks on the screen. So I guess I'm kind of curious about if there's work, or have you ever thought about like how this kind of web-based experiments, especially when it comes to actually interact with physics, how it translates to like real world actually playing with wooden blocks? Because I feel like when people are in the real world playing blocks, there are also like additional cues, such as you can like feel the blocks, you can feel how heavy they are, and you can like have the texture, and maybe there's just like more information, you can hold the blocks in your hand and look at it. So there seems to be like more cues in terms of like building actual physical blocks. So I guess I'm wondering if you have thought about how doing this via like a lab-based environment versus like doing it in an in-lab experiment? How do these two approaches compare with each other?
Yeah, no, thanks for the question. So our study takes direct inspiration from some other work also published in the COGSci proceedings a few years ago, looking at how children perform a similar task with physical Legos. So children were brought into the lab, given a target tower, maybe consisting of 4 or 6 Legos, and they were asked to reconstruct these in a tabletop setup. And both children and adults were asked to do this. And I just thought it was like the coolest study in trying to think about the kinds of errors that children and adults made, and like the kind of errors that led to what kind of backtracking, the kinds of strategies that different participants used. And one of the insights that they had was that this layer-wise strategy, where if you have some complex tower, like a Lego tower that has multiple levels, that some participants who are able to successfully solve these towers and recreate them focused on completing a level before starting the next one, as a way of assigning themselves, you could think, you know, sub goals to reach, kind of intermediate milestones along the way that were also, you know, consistent with the way that they parsed the tower visually and physically, perhaps. And so we took a lot of inspiration from those studies, looking at how people play with physical Legos and, you know, use physical Legos to recreate, you know, more complex structures. And so with, you know, the web-based platform that we developed, more accurately, that Will designed and developed, I think is a really powerful extension of that idea, in that it allowed us to recruit a much larger sample of participants to our study. It also helped us to isolate the kinds of visual parsing and planning processes that we were really interested in this case. I think I completely agree with you that there are also factors that are really important for like a full account of how people manipulate real physical objects in order to create more, you know, in order to create more complex things. And I think that it's a direction that I'm very excited about, you know, evolving this work towards, that, you know, the ability to focus on the planning and the kind of visual segmentation, if you will, those aspects of the task and behavior have been really valuable for helping us to refine our measures. But, you know, one direction that I'm super excited about is using virtual reality and other kinds of technologies that allow us as cognitive researchers to embed participants in well-controlled environments that also you know, better approximate the physical reality of like, you know, real world behavior and physical reasoning and spatial reasoning and decision making. So I think that that's like along our path, but we thought that this was like a really great way to get started on those questions in a way that would also be really scientifically valuable.
I see. So you mentioned that you drew like this line of work, kind of drew inspiration from the kids like building Lego study. So one thing that I'm really fascinated was, I remember there was one time when I was working in a developmental lab when I'm like babysitting like a toddler's, like a sibling. And the kids just seems to be so fascinated by those like giant blocks. And she just kept building and building and building and building. And it's almost like she has this intrinsic motivation to build something out of blocks, out of components. And I have to say, like, I actually look around at the GitHub and I was looking at the animations of how the experiments were done. And I was like, oh, that was a really cool and fun study to run. And I mean, even as adults, I sometimes steal like ball set of Lego just because it's fun to play. So I guess I'm curious, have you ever thought, or has there been study on why people find joy, find fun in terms of like doing this building activities? Like, why do people enjoy it so much?
I'm so glad you asked. It's a question that I think is in some ways hiding in plain sight in our paper that we didn't get a chance to directly address in the short CogSci submission. But I think you're absolutely right. This activity, it's fun, right? There's something about, building sandcastles, even if we know that the tide is going to wash it away, that still is worth it, right? And that somehow, like, we're okay, cooking an elaborate meal, even though we know that it's, then we're immediately going to eat it and then it'll be gone. The act of creation, I think, is something that is enormously rewarding and intrinsically motivating. And I think that, I've also been really indebted to and take a lot of inspiration from other work in psychology and in artificial intelligence that have asked about what characterizes these activities that we're intrinsically motivated to engage in. Why are we curious about, like, what makes the Leaning Tower of Pisa so interesting to look at and so iconic? What makes, arrangements of rocks on hiking trails? I'm not sure exactly what the name is of this phenomenon, but these very Instagrammable, telegenic stacks of precariously balanced rocks that you may find. Like, what draws us to create those entities and, like, what makes them so interesting to look at? So, in the last 6 months or so, actually together with some of your colleagues at Stanford and some interested collaborators here at UC San Diego, we've been starting to scratch the surface of this question in this domain of tower building. So we've been generating a variety of, again, virtual simulated towers embedded in a 3D environment. So in a virtual reality environment with realistic simulated gravity, composing a variety of different towers and showing them to people and asking them, how interesting is this tower to look at? Is this the kind of tower that would be, motivating to build, right? Because there are these building towers of our own design, as kids and playing with Legos is like a super complex and fascinating behavior. And one of the questions that we asked ourselves early on is, when we compare the kinds of structures that adults build, I mean, either with Legos or with bricks and logs and, the kinds of cities that people build, and we compare the kinds of Lego towers that children play with and create early in life, what explains the similarities and differences between the kinds of structures that that people across the lifespan are drawn to making and bringing into the world, right? And we hypothesized that we could get some leverage on this question by designing a task that doesn't necessarily require people to engage in all those difficult planning processes that we were just talking about in the other study. So it's really hard to, even if you have a tower in mind, to figure out which block to place where and which order in order to realize it. And so to simplify the task, we instead synthesized a bunch of towers that varied in their height and the way in which the different blocks were configured in space, and the colors and the textures, in order to understand, what makes some towers so interesting to look at, right? And it's a really basic question that I think, I think could, be a really useful first step towards understanding these really exploratory, open-ended, playful behaviors that we see early in life, but also, to be honest, throughout the lifespan And so that's a quite new direction that we're currently pursuing too, which is connecting both, how people think about and reason about these kinds of complex physical structures, how they understand them, how they interact with them, the constraints on their ability to plan their actions when building them or decomposing them, and connecting that understanding to understanding of this behavior, which is absolutely you can't avoid when you look around, that people enjoy creating new things, right? And it's a kind of activity that emerges quite early in life. And I'm really excited about the kind of growing scientific understanding of curiosity and intrinsic motivation. But I think, there are more unanswered questions than there are satisfying answers to them still. But yeah, I think you're totally right that, figuring out, for instance, how and why, say, kids enjoy, this is a slightly idiosyncratic term, but entropy cycling in their environments. So it's really fun if, your caregiver builds some tower and then you knock it over and you see pieces fly everywhere. It's like very, very exciting and it's really fun. And there's something kind of unpredictable and surprising about the way that those pieces fly apart that is really cool. But we also observe among maybe, in like toddlers and older children, and also in adults, the ability to gather those blocks back up again and build something. So go from kind of like a high entropy state to a lower entropy state, and then knock it over again, and then come back and then sort of rebuild again. And that is a kind of, this cycling between high entropy and low entropy states, if you will, if you'll indulge me, that, is something that we take for granted as what it looks like to play. But what about that is so enjoyable? What about those can be, thought of potentially as experiments that the individual is conducting in order to learn about how the world works, which relations between objects can lead to really surprising and interesting results, how high of a tower you can build that looks like it has no right to still be standing and still is, right? There's like something really marvelous, right? That we marvel at these structures that somehow defy gravity or sort of defy our expectations, that make some buildings really impressive. And I think that, getting to the bottom of that, I think, is going to be like a really exciting and important challenge that we're, just taking baby steps towards, tackling in these initial studies.
I know you mentioned gravity a lot of times throughout our conversations, but I feel like in some sense, gravity is this kind of relative abstract people study like in classroom thing. So I know in the paper you briefly discuss how like this has implications with how our understanding of intuitive physics. So I wonder if you can unpack a little bit about intuitive physics, because when we look at young children, when they're building towers, I mean, they really, really wanted to stand really, really tall, but probably don't understand anything about gravity in the very abstract sense, but still they're getting that like that sense of marvelous from the tower that they built. So I wonder if you can say more about like how young children understand the physical world around them.
I mean, I think it's a really important connection to make, is that one constraint that all animals share living on Earth is that we're subject to the physical laws and physical forces, gravity being an unavoidable one so long as you're living on the surface of the Earth. And so even though people may not spontaneously develop formalized theories of how gravity works, people nevertheless do learn how to pick up objects, manipulate them, throw and catch balls in a way that eventually seems effortless. And I think that understanding that ability, which you named intuitive physics, has been a puzzle that's been of interest to cognitive scientists through the decades. And I think what's really an exciting set of questions that pertain to intuitive physics that I would hope more people could, you know, think about is how we are continually able to adapt to new physical circumstances and new physical environments and sort of new physical challenges across the lifespan. So, for example, when it's a windy day, say you're throwing a frisbee back and forth, it makes a really big difference which way the wind is blowing, right? For catching it. And it's something that we can adapt to, that we can plan when deciding which direction to throw, how hard to throw it, and also through trial and error. If we see that the frisbee veers off in the, you know, too far to the left, we can take that into account the next time we're, you know, planning our next throw. We are drawn towards and seek out, you know, new hobbies and sports that require us to calibrate to new physical environments. So, for example, even if you haven't grown up in a place with a lot of snow, this describes my hometown in Phoenix, Arizona, you might find yourself in a snowy climate on a hill and figure out how you're going to get down, right? How do you navigate or say ski down the slope? We're capable of doing this. It's even something that we seek out and spend resources to engage in. What is going on when we adapt to those sort of new physical constraints? And why is that so interesting to us? Why is it interesting to go skydiving for some? Or like, why is it maybe not surprising that when the first people landed on the moon, they could casually play pickup sports, even though gravity was a very different, you know, strength there than it is on the surface of the Earth? We have this flexibility as humans to not only adapt to different physical circumstances and environments within our lifetimes, but also we seek out those experiences too. And I think that kind of playful, that kind of, you know, physical curiosity, if you will, about different physical environments is a super interesting and important question that I think is in some ways hiding in plain sight, that it's a question that we often ask in a developmental context, which is very important, which is how do children learn to calibrate their actions and expectations to the kind of everyday physical phenomena that, you know, are unfolding around them. But how is that learning and that those developmental processes continuous with a kind of lifelong learning and continual adaptation that grownups display throughout our lives? So that's at least the angle that I've been taking to thinking about what the open questions are here. So I appreciate your questions about that.
Yeah, so I want to be mindful of time, and it has been wonderful talking to you. I guess as we are wrapping up this conversation, I want to kind of like, I know you mentioned a little bit about the next step, but I'm wondering if you can share more about like what you see that this line of work is leading. Like, what are some next steps that you're considering you're most excited to pursue after finding that people are building these old cool, like these very cool blocks in very cool ways?
Yeah, so I've spilled the beans already on some of the directions that I'm really excited about, which is, you know, examining this behavior in more naturalistic, complex 3D environments, you know, getting back to physical Legos as close as we can, as well as asking these questions about intrinsic motivation and exploration, what makes these activities both challenging and fun for people of all ages. And I'd say a third axis that I'm really excited about, I think is really important, is, you know, theories of how perception and action interact in the brain. So a A common view might be that you have perception and the ability to make sense of the visual world that is handled by a set of operations performed in the brain that processes visual information. And then you have other parts of the brain that worry about motor control and, you know, deciding when and how to act. And I think what looking at behaviors like tower building or looking at other behaviors where people are not only able to look at objects and make sense of them, but can also really intervene on them and even create new examples of them, I think are a really important case study that challenges the kind of standard theories of how these are separate processes that are accomplished separately in the brain and think about how they interact. So how does, for example, you know, in another line of work that we're pursuing in the lab, we're looking at how our ability to draw and make sketches that look like things in the world affects the way that we understand those objects when we look at them and the kind of the meaning that they have when we view them. And, you know, there's other work looking at the relationship between reading and writing. How does the experience of printing letters or writing characters in the language that your community uses affect and interact with your ability to read text in that language? These are obviously really important, you know, classes of activities that are that we engage in on a daily basis, writing and drawing and making things. And I think that looking at these behaviors and really trying to understand how they work and how experience shapes how people engage in them also has implications for our theories of how these two behaviors that have been traditionally studied separately, perception and action, may be really intimately connected in the mind.
Awesome. It's been wonderful talking to you. And I want to thank you again for joining us on the podcast. And I'm very looking forward to see the future directions on this line of work.
Thank you so much for having me. This was really a delight.